Manhattan to Shamokin, Wellsboro to Uniontown, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, employers frequently cite the difficulty in finding and keeping qualified employees as one of their biggest challenges. Is that because the nation's workforce has stopped appreciating the value of honest labor? David Taylor is joined by Rebecca Euler and Stephen Bloom for this week's Capital Watch Roundtable discussion. And he is perhaps the most intriguing member of the U.S. Senate. But what impact will John Fetterman's tendency to independent thinking have on his re-election chances? I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first news headlines from patownhall.com. You may be pro-life, but now your tax dollars will be paying for elective abortions funded through the Medicaid system. Commonwealth Court upended long-standing public policy that protected the life of the unborn child by ruling the state's ban on Medicaid funding for elective abortions is unconstitutional. Michael Geer of the Pennsylvania Family Institute slammed the court for, quote, overstepping its authority and ignoring the plain text of our state constitution, end quote. The issue is likely to be appealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. With billions of federal dollars hanging in the balance, U.S. Senator Dave McCormick visited a Jewish day school in Harrisburg to push for Governor Josh Shapiro to opt Pennsylvania into the new federal tax credit scholarship program. Despite the fact the program takes not a single dollar from public schools, teacher unions oppose its implementation. Shapiro has a history of caving to teacher union demands, raising concerns that he may leave money on the table that could help poor and minority school students have more and better educational choices. Pennsylvania State House Democrats recently passed their version of the state budget, which calls for spending some $7 billion more than the Commonwealth is projected to receive in revenue. Not to be outdone, Pittsburgh City Council this week voted to increase spending this year by $28 million, despite the fact the city already faced a significant budget deficit. Council plans to pull more money from reserve funds to cover the deficit. No explanation as to what will happen next year when there are no reserve funds left to tap. The NFL draft is certainly bringing a lot of attention to Pittsburgh. Hopefully that is good attention. As Reason Magazine notes, tens of millions of taxpayer dollars have been spent on the event, much of it on marketing. Here's to hoping the Steelers and Eagles get a few good picks out of the deal. It is known as quiet quitting, millions of working-age Americans leaving the workforce. Is the value of honest labor no longer appreciated? Our Capital Watch crew is here to discuss that question. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation for a Capital Watch discussion. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capital Watch All-Stars from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, President and CEO, Rebecca Euler. Rebecca, welcome back.
It's great to be back again, Dave. Thank you.
Great to be with you. And my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me here, David. I appreciate it.
Well, it's wonderful to be together again. And for the listeners who were with us last week, I want to springboard off of the conversation that Steve, that you and I were having at that time. We were talking about the large amount of money that's spent on social welfare programs in the U.S. And of course, attendant to that are all the scandals that have been breaking about massive fraud that we've seen uncovered in Minnesota and in California and in Maine and other places. And you wonder how much more of this is going on. And of course, that Governor Shapiro specifically is refusing to cooperate with the federal authorities to check our records to try to stop fraud here. But Steve, you and I were talking about the social safety net and the social benefit programs, and that your point was, people in general are not opposed to those sorts of programs so long as the help is actually going to the people who really deserve it and need it.
Correct.
And that we're helping them to better themselves, not just like keeping them in a perpetual state of dependence.
Absolutely. And that's the danger. And I think that's the danger of the social welfare programs, and mixing that with government creates a situation where it encourages people to be less productive. It's apparently by design or by failure to understand how important that is. When you mentioned that we would be discussing the whole topic of working in America, it reminded me to grab my copy of Free to Choose, the classic book by Milton Friedman and his wife Rose Friedman.
Yes.
This book is written in 1980, and from the jacket of the book, I just want to read a sentence. They show us how our freedom has been eroded and our prosperity undermined through the explosion of laws, regulations, agencies, and spending in Washington, how good intentions often produce deplorable results when government is the middleman.
Well, the truer words were never spoken.
45 years ago.
And these things are ever true. And so, Rebecca, healing off of that, I sent around to you guys a commentary that I had seen recently in the Wall Street Journal, that they have a columnist, a fellow named Barton Swaim, whose work I enjoy very much. And the essay that I shared was America Loses Its Will to Work, subtitled From the War on Poverty to Quiet Quitting, We've Stopped Appreciating the Value of Honest Labor.
I thought this was a great essay because it really went into quite a bit of detail about the idea of democracy in America. It goes into Alexis de Tocqueville's classic book, Democracy in America, and the things that make America special, and how the American idea of freedom and free markets and democracy work together to really build the society that we've built in America and have made America prosperous. So what this essay is sort of concluding is that when we went into the 60s and built the war on poverty and gave folks sort of built a social safety net so that there was an entitlement to get social programs, it sort of weakened the values on which the whole system was built.
Yeah. I mean, I think that really crystallizes the thought. And even though the author in the essay doesn't come upon this, it reminds me of the founders. I mean, America's birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence, you know, the unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the way the founders meant the pursuit of happiness, it wasn't just like go have fun, that for them, the pursuit of personal happiness, personal satisfaction was to live a good, meaningful, productive, virtuous life, to attempt to become one's best self. And that, like, that's what liberty is for. It isn't just to kick back and relax. It's to apply yourself and to make a positive difference in the world. All of those things were predicated. Those were presuppositions of the founders, that this is what people were meant for. And it brings me around to the point that you guys have heard me say over and over, that human beings have inherent dignity and worth and value and potential, and that human beings were never meant to be kept like house pets or zoo animals.
And the key is, did in fact, are people better off when they're freed, and I'll use that term loosely, from the need to work or the desire to work? Historically, as you mentioned, for 250 years, this country had a reverence for work. It was something that people sought, honorable work. They treated their job seriously. Whether or not it was a fancy job with a big title, hard labor, whatever it was, Americans revered work. They respected it in others, and they appreciated the impact it had on them as individuals.
Yes, and that was part of the social contract and part of the immigrant experience. People came to America to work, expecting hard work, whether that was settling the frontier and dealing with the harshness of winters on the Great Plains or any of those things, or whether it was coming to America to work in factories, to be part of the Industrial Revolution. Nobody came here just expecting a free ride with handouts or anything else. It was expected that it would be an opportunity to work and to improve one's state through focused, diligent effort. And that's gone.
And you have to wonder, what would have LBJ, if he could come back to the future and see what had happened as a result of his Great Society initiative back in the 1960s, did that bring any sort of victory? Did it turn out to be positive for the Americans and the way they feel about life and their optimism about the future? Or was it a war on work, essentially, rather than a war on poverty?
Well, there are trade-offs to everything, of course, and that the author gives credit here to say that that people at the absolute bottom of the economic ladder, that they are materially better off. He questions how much of that was brought about by market innovation and new goods and services and products enabling all of us to live better, as opposed to this, you know, government intervention, which certainly, you know, did some good, but at the same time also did damage to our social structure. But another thing that intrigues me about the author's approach here is he talks about a number of different factors that are, as Shakespeare would say, that they dull the edge of husbandry, and that one of them is recreational marijuana, and talking also about sports betting, and that the numbers are shocking, that like half of all young American men between 18 and 30 have a sports gambling account. And that it's actually creating a financial crisis where you have young men who are, I mean, inevitably there are people who get in over their head, who get addicted, who spend more than they should, spend more than they have, and that this cuts against working, saving, capital formation, being able to buy a house, all those kinds of things that we would associate with being a mature person, being an adult, and that when you have... And again, you guys and the listeners have heard me say this a number of times. When you have the government, in this case, you know, the Pennsylvania state government, the Commonwealth, Governor Shapiro wants to mass commercialize recreational marijuana. Well, in every other state where this has been deployed, what happens is that usage increases. It isn't just the argument by the advocates is, well, we're just capturing the money from what people are already using. Well, that's not true. That people go from being occasional users to being daily users. People who wouldn't otherwise use it, now that it's legal, that they start. And, you know, I remember as a kid, the most effective drug ad I ever saw was a darkened room and a guy in a basement with the blink of a TV screen smoking weed, and that the voiceover said, "What happens when you smoke marijuana? Nothing." In the sense of like, your life is stuck in neutral. You don't apply yourself. You get stuck there. Nothing will happen. Nothing will change. You won't get to grow up or lead a real life or do all those other things. Like, and again, I don't want to be a terrible scold about this, but like, smoking marijuana does not make you smarter. Smoking marijuana does not make you sharper. It doesn't make you more motivated. It doesn't work for any of the positive virtues that we as a society need. And I guess this is one of my other points, and I'm going to rant here until you guys tackle me, but that in the same way that people were never meant to be kept like pets or zoo animals, that we as a society, for all the people, what, you know, regardless of who you are or where you are, the whole rest of society needs you, in the sense of like, we need the benefit of your contribution. Like, you as a person have something special to offer that only you can bring, and that we are all poorer when you were not involved.
It becomes very blatant when you put it in those terms. And Rebecca, I'm sure you're familiar with this, and David, from your travels around the state, we all have the type of work that involves meeting people, a lot of industrial leaders, manufacturers, entrepreneurs all across Pennsylvania on a regular basis. And for about 15 years or so, when you ask them how they're doing, what would help them be more successful, they'll immediately, and everyone's shaking their heads right now in the radio studio, because you know that it's going to be workforce issues.
Yeah,
they don't have enough employees for good paying jobs with great benefits in a meaningful in a production of a meaningful asset to our well-being as a society, but there aren't people to work the jobs. There's something tragic has happened where those people who in the past would have jumped at the opportunity to get in on the ground floor of a good paying job with good benefits, with a safe place to work and opportunities, but now there's so many for a chronic number of years, year after year, of folks, their number one problem is that they can't fund people to fulfill the important jobs they have.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation. And Steve, that's exactly right. This workforce crisis is a real challenge to the overall economy because it winds up being, as I've said before, a hard cap on economic growth. That if our employers are having a difficult time finding enough qualified new hires to continue operations at the current level, then there's no chance to actually expand operations. And I hear the stories where like there's work to bid on, but we can't go after it because we can't find the people to add another product line or add a third shift. And so it's a terrible trend. And I would just the other point that I would tack onto that at the end is that with the dignity of work and the dignity of self-sufficiency, also that it's through work, through applying our talents that we know that we matter. Mm. Like this is how we touch the world around us. And for people to be deprived of that, it's like you said, it's a tragedy.
Yeah, and I would add, not only that, I agree that we all depend on everybody fulfilling their own individual purpose in society. And we need to enable people to find that purpose, to be able to contribute good to society and productive input to society. But the other thing that I would add to that is when you have so many people that aren't contributing and are sitting on the sidelines and are sitting around in their basement smoking pot or whatever, then the productive people in society see that and they say, well, why am I bothering?
Right.
Why am I bothering to produce so much? Why am I working so much? Why am I working so hard? Then why don't I just sit on the sidelines?
It's demoralizing,
too?
And it makes
it just snowballs. It snowballs in the productive sector, and that's a shame. But I did want to say I was just talking to a group of truck company members last night who were just talking about this issue of they can't find drivers. So there are no qualified truck drivers that are applying to companies right now. And it's a real problem. And as we know, trucking is sort of the backbone of all of our industries.
Sure.
Because
it's the circulatory system of our economy.
You can't move products. You can't move raw materials. We talk a lot about energy on this show. You can't produce energy without truck drivers. So if you can't have truck drivers and you can't smoke marijuana if you're a truck driver, not allowed to be on the road.
Correct. Bright line, divider there. Like,
right.
We can't hire you. We can't have you.
Yeah. So one of the impacts on the trucking industry that this is having is one of the big problems is they can't find over the road drivers. So people who are willing to go out for 2 weeks at a time, for example, on the road, that just isn't happening anymore. People aren't willing to give that much. Whereas in the past, they got value out of that. They found some reward in that. So now the trucking companies are breaking down the routes so that they're day-long routes. So everybody can get home at night, and they needed to do that in order to get drivers in the doors to apply for jobs, which is fine. And that's the adaptation.
It's innovation.
That's true. And that's the adaptation that the industry has had to make to get drivers to apply for these jobs, which is fantastic. But the thing we have to understand is that's increasing costs for everybody
Right. Throughout
the entire supply chain. So we talk about affordability when you need to make accommodation for things like this. And that's just the example of truck drivers. You could make that example throughout all of workforce where you have to make accommodations to sort of get people in the door to work that increase costs for everyone. And we talk about affordability. So this is something that contributes to affordability.
The economy and society evolve as life changes around us. And if there are concessions like that that wind up being made, if that's what's necessary to find the people to do the work, then hopefully those people will, you know, have better quality of life and that they'll have the contentment of being home in the evening and things like that. But it's the people who are completely on the sidelines. And the author of the commentary, and again, we're talking about Barton Swaim, and the commentary that he ran recently in the Wall Street Journal, that America loses its will to work, that he says that we shouldn't just castigate younger people who wind up in that situation of not working and being outside the workforce, because, as I was saying, that society, and I would say particularly government, has put a lot of these temptations and stumbling blocks in their way. And that, you know, we need to have an economy that is robust and growing and offering a plentiful and promising opportunities for employment, but also that we need, not that the state should ever be in loco parentis, we're not wards of the state, we're citizens, but at the same time, lead us not into temptation. There's a lot of wisdom in that. And if we had truly virtuous, publicly spirited leaders, they would not want people to have the bad outcomes that will result from creating new sins so that we can have new revenue from sin taxes.
Yeah, and it is, you know, human beings respond to incentives. There's no doubt about that. The free market is premised on the fact that because of those incentives that are created by the laws of economics, not mm-hmm. by human laws, but
correct.
Literally observing the science of economics, that's how people get motivated. And what these laws and these attempts to help people often does is undermines that incentive and makes it unclear, what should I be doing? What will I do? I'll take the easiest path. Mm-hmm. The easiest path may be, you know, back to the couch.
Right.
That's the problem we see. But we've got to remember that economic incentives still drive the outcomes.
So I just, again, this is a very complex and difficult challenge. Anyway, this has been sort of a philosophical roundtable. I'm not sure exactly what the takeaways are, but anyway, thanks for being with me to kick it around. And for folks, again, who've been listening, it's America Loses the Will to Work, a column by Barton Swaim recently in the Wall Street Journal. Do a search and pull that down. But we're out of time. Rebecca, where can people go to find you and learn about you and your organization, the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association?
Yes, they can find us at pmta.org.
Outstanding. And Steve, where can people go online to find out more about you and the work that you do?
They can go to commonwealthfoundation.org.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. And from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks so much for listening. We will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. As the 2022 U.S. Senate election between Republican Dr. Mehmet Oz and Democrat John Fetterman approached, I wrote, quote, "If John Fetterman is elected to the U.S. Senate, he will make Bernie Sanders look like Ted Cruz." Millions of Democratic voters thought the same. We were all wrong. Pennsylvania's now senior U.S. senator has become an outlier in Washington, D.C. On most issues, he continues to hew the progressive line. But he has also shown a willingness to stray from that line if he believes it is wrong. Senator Fetterman has been a strong defender of Israel. He believes our borders should be secure. He has refused to participate in his party's government shutdown antics, saying government should never be shut down. He has supported President Donald Trump's cabinet picks. He even had dinner with the president. Such independence is not well regarded in Washington by either party, but especially by the left, which views any deviation from their radical progressive positions as apostasy. The result is that Fetterman is being pilloried by his own party. His poll numbers among Democrats have tanked, but his approval among Republicans have grown steadily. Speculation is already intense as to Fetterman's fate in 2028, when, should he want to remain in office, he will face what is shaping up to be a brutal re-election campaign. There are three options. Fetterman could run for re-election in the Democratic primary. To a significant degree, those primaries have become dominated by the far left wing of the party, those who feel betrayed by the senator. His only real chance of being nominated is in a multi-candidate field that splits the anti-Fetterman vote. Several potential candidates are already dipping their toes in the political water, so a large field of candidates is possible. Republican State Party Chairman Greg Rothman raised eyebrows recently when he said having Fetterman switch parties and run as a Republican is, quote, not off the table. It is true that Fetterman's job approval with Republican voters is higher than among Democrats, but the GOP's conservative wing seems unlikely to embrace a candidate who overall has a solid progressive voting record. The last Pennsylvania U.S. senator to switch parties was Arlen Specter. For decades, Specter had vexed the conservative wing of his party, but employing what became known as the Specter Shuffle, Specter would tilt left for 2 or 3 years after each election and then tack back to the middle just enough to secure renomination. That worked until it didn't. In 2010, facing a potential losing primary against former Congressman Pat Toomey, Specter switched parties. He earned the endorsement of state Democratic leaders, but the grassroots wasn't about to embrace a former Republican. He lost the primary to Congressman Joe Sestak, who was then in turn defeated by Toomey in the general election. Perhaps the most intriguing option available to Fetterman is to ditch both political parties and run as an independent. You likely must have to go back before the Civil War to find a candidate who ran and won statewide on other than the Democratic or Republican ticket. But then again, Pennsylvanians always reelected incumbent governors until they didn't. There are two independents currently serving in the U.S. Senate, Vermont's Bernie Sanders and Angus King of Maine. Their independence only goes so far, as both caucus with Senate Democrats. Former U.S. Senator Kristen Sinema of Arizona and West Virginia's Joe Manchin both became independents, but only after having been reelected as Democrats. Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, who, like Fetterman, angered his party by charting his own course, was, prior to Sanders and King, the last independent elected to the U.S. Senate. It would be interesting to see if Fetterman could retain enough Democratic support, coupled with Republican voters who no longer view him as unpalatable, to win. Keeping in mind the most rapidly growing group of voters in Penn's Woods are independents, and a case for a viable independent candidacy can be made. Fetterman would also benefit from the fact that Pennsylvania is a non-runoff state. That means in a general election, the winning candidate is not required to ever get over 50% of the vote. The winning candidate must simply get the most votes. It could take less than 40% of the vote to win. All of this, of course, is speculation, and we do have the 2026 midterms lying right in front of us. The only thing that can be said with certainty is that with John Fetterman in the mix, it will not be boring. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WRSC-FM in Bellefonte, WQMU-FM in Indiana, and WHYU-FM in Myersdale, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.